I want to add my voice to the best wishes to all of you who are moms, and we thank the Lord for you, as has been prayed, and we believe that that's in keeping with the scriptures that have been read today. So very happy day to each one of you. I have chosen this time to write about the role of moms in the bulletin, and then to speak in our assembly today about the faith, the kind of faith which makes a godly mom godly. And while I'm not going to mention mothers very much in this study today, you realize that I'm talking about the outlook or the foundation for godly a godly woman's approach to life, and as well as godly anyone else. I believe that it would be appropriate for me today to begin by acknowledging some things about our faith, things that we recognize. Sometimes people accuse us of leaving the wrong impression about. Let me be honest with you. Being a Christian is no guarantee that you or those you love are going to be kept separate from the harsh realities that seem to occur at random in this fallen world. Even if you're a Christian, the storms, the accidents, sometimes the diseases that strike everyone else have to be dealt with in your life as well. Being a Christian carries no promise of a quick triumph over human weaknesses or of easy avoidances of the offenses that go with those weaknesses or immediate satisfaction of your wishes and dreams. The fact is that when a person has been a Christian one day, he's a baby in Christ, and he still struggles with many of the same things he did the day before. We have an enemy who sees to that, and life itself seems to make sure that reality is present in us and in our fellow Christians. Being a Christian, thirdly, may even bring hardship your way. It's certain that being a Christian will require discipline from within yourself, and it's possible that it could bring disapproval from other people, maybe even difficulty into your life. And we admit, we recognize those three realities, and yet we believe that there is something about the faith we hold as Christians which is so valuable that it's irreplaceable. We believe that it has a value that should not ever be ignored or forgotten by those who hold to our faith, and that it should be considered by everyone who has not made the good confession and who has questions about things. What is the value in what Christians believe? In the part of 2 Corinthians we're going to refer to today, it's a place where Paul is defending his ministry against opponents, harsh opponents, and he's been describing where he finds the resources to go on. I think this is a good place for us to look for answers that we need as well. The opening phrases of each of the three brief paragraphs that we're going to consider this morning have a line of thought. Let me put them together, and you think of it this way. So we do not lose heart, for we know what we have, so we're always of good courage. That's the three thoughts tied together. And woven through these paragraphs and the reasoning that occurs here are three of the great values of faith in Christ. We just take them one at a time. First off, what Christians believe is so valuable because it gives our struggle meaning. In 2 Corinthians 4 and verses 16 through 18, we have, "So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." Now, in the beginning of that passage is the recognition that a human being might well lose heart. He might well grow weary. He might well faint. And that picture involves someone's body language and his knees kind of beginning to be wobbly and then his faith just collapsing. It could happen anyway. Paul's way of thinking about life was generally a marathon that had to be run, or a fight that had to be fought, or a struggle to hold on to something that had to be kept. In his case, there were terrible afflictions that went along with this by way of persecution. In chapter 1 of this letter, in verses 8 and 9, Paul mentions that in Asia, he had been through something that was such a burden that it caused him to despair of life itself. We can only imagine how what he's talking about might have fit into the things he's been through that he describes over in chapter 11 with deprivation and danger and disaster time after time that he had experienced. But you know, even without those kinds of terrible afflictions, we human beings find ourselves wondering from time to time whether the struggle we go through is worth it or not. Back in the Old Testament, in Psalm 73, there's an occasion when the very honest psalmist says, "But as for me, my feet had almost stumbled. My steps had nearly slipped." And a little later in the psalm, Psalm 73, verse 12, he starts telling us why. "Behold, these are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches." At least that's how it was looking to him at a time. And then he says, "All in vain have I kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. For all the day long I have been stricken and rebuked every morning." Most people in their heart of hearts can admit times in their lives when that feeling is present. And maybe you understand that yourself today. Paul, however, says we don't lose heart. Even though our outer man may be wasting away, and he's saying here, this jar of clay, this mortal flesh, he's referred to in verses 7 and 11, the toll of the years and the miles and the beatings are taking their toll on it. And it's wasting away. It's subject to decay and corruption and wearing out and weakness and all of those things. But even though that is happening, our inner man, he says, the part of us which is responsive to God's will, the part of us in which the Spirit of the Lord can abide, the part of us which enlivens our body and causes it to take the actions and choices it takes, that part of us, he says, is being renewed day by day. Some writer said that the best commentary on Paul's statement is actually the passage John read from the end of Ephesians 3 this morning. How the inner man, the person can be strengthened by his spirit and the inner man so as to know the love of Christ. In Paul's case, Perhaps he's described what he meant here in chapter 4, if you back up to verse 7. He says, "We have this treasure in jars of clay to show the surpassing power belongs to God and not to us. We're afflicted in every way, but not crushed, perplexed, but not driven to despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may be also manifested in our bodies." Someone who rejects Christ might need to explain what else in life can keep people from being crushed, from despairing, from feeling forsaken, from being destroyed even in the presence of difficulty. We sang the song that has the quote from Isaiah 40 in it. Did you notice this idea about God's nature? In Isaiah 40, at the end of the chapter, there's the description of the renewing God, if I can refer to him that way. This God, this everlasting creator of the ends of the earth, does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint, and to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted. That's the outer man. But here's the inner man. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. How will they? The renewing God renews their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. That's what Paul says he hasn't done. He's not fainted. He's not grown weary. And this renewing goes on day by day. In this passage, it's not talking about the gradual growth that occurs in a Christian life. It's talking about the way the inner man finds strength to God through God to do what he needs to do, even while the outward man is feeling the pressure. And Paul says, actually, there is something here that's there's a kind of a dichotomy that really illustrates a blessing that Christians enjoy, which is beyond all comparison. On the one hand, he says, there is affliction, which is light and momentary. You read through some of what Paul had been through, and you think to yourself, his definition of light and momentary is pretty impressive, if you think about that. On the other hand, he says, as opposed to affliction, there is glory. And as opposed to its being light, it has weight. And as opposed to its being momentary, it is eternal. And he says, God is preparing us for this. Even when he allows us to go through the struggles, even by insisting that we be faithful in the struggles, God is preparing us for this eternal weight of glory that Paul talks about here. But in order for this to happen, Paul admits that we have to see things, not the things that are seen and transient or passing, but we have to look at things that are unseen and eternal. I think I may have been reading this wrong for all these years. I've always just read over this quickly and thought Paul is talking about looking at the invisible things and instead of the physical things around. But it occurs to me as I think about this, that's not what he's saying at all. What he's saying is, right now, we live in the transient situation where the faith that we hold is not yet seen in its fulfillment. We have promises. We know what has happened with Christ. But But we don't yet see him face to face, as John led us in singing about earlier. What we look to is that unseen, that which is presently unseen, that time when we'll see the Lord face to face and when we'll be like him. That's what we as Christians look at. That's glory to us. In about 1850, Robert Browning wrote, I'm not sure if it's a two-part poem or one poem with two great parts, but Christmas Eve and Easter. And really it was a situation when he was influenced heavily by his wife's faith more than his own. But in this part of his poem, Browning writes about a martyr, an early Christian martyr who'd lost his life for his faith under the Roman power at the time. And this martyr tells his story, and he says his story was set out on the rude tablet overhead. You can imagine it, one of these screens if you want to. But let me do my best to ask you to think about this vivid scene. This is the martyr. "I was born sickly, poor, and mean, a slave. No mystery could screen the holders of the pearl of price from Caesar's envy. Therefore, twice I fought with beasts, and three times saw my children suffer by his law. At last my own release was earned. I was some time in being burned. But at the close, a hand came through the fire above my head and drew my soul to Christ, whom now I see. Sergius, a brother, writes for me this testimony on the wall. For me, I have forgot it all." One great value of our faith is that it gives meaning to our struggle. Secondly, and very importantly, what Christians believe gives our deepest longing, which is a longing to live, a longing for life, a fulfillment. In 2 Corinthians 5, here's verses 1 through 5. "For we know that if the tent of our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we were still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee." Notice that connection between our being prepared at the end of chapter 4 and God's preparing us for something. What's being contemplated in this passage is the reality of the mortality of our physical bodies. Anyone who has not thought about the temporary nature of this body seems to be unprepared to live, if you really think about it. Our thinking about our mortal physical nature causes us to discover life in its real true setting. In Psalm 39 in the Old Testament, the writer says, verse 4 and following, "O Lord, make me to know my end and what is the measure of my days. Let me know how fleeting I am. Behold, you've made my days a few handbreadths, and my lifetime is as nothing before you. Surely all mankind stands as a mere breath. Surely a man goes about as a shadow. Surely for nothing they are in turmoil. Man heaps up wealth and does not know who will gather. And now, O Lord, for what do I wait?" What's your answer to that question? You can't argue with his assessment of human experience. We are a few handbreadths. And the older we grow, the more we realize how quickly and how temporary was all of the time that went before. But Paul says, for we know that if this earthly house or this earthly tent we have is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. It'd be easy to read that and just think he's talking about heaven itself. But if you really think about what Paul is saying here, what he's talking about is the resurrection body. The core Christian conviction is not only that there was a cross, but also that there was a resurrection. And Paul says we know this. We know it because he taught them at the end of 1 Corinthians, read 1 Corinthians 15, by revelation, this entire idea, this entire concept of what the resurrection of Christ will mean in our experience. There are three illustrations Paul depends on in developing the thought in our paragraph here that even if this physical body is wasting away, we have another body, a body of glory, a resurrection body in heaven because of the work of Christ. It's not talking about just, I want to be in heaven. It's saying, we expect this body of glory through the work of Christ. The first illustration is the tent. A dwelling place that could be set up and lived in for a while and then struck down and moved to somewhere else. In Paul's day, his people had been accustomed to the Feast of Tabernacles, where they made booths out of brush and they lived in them a little while in order to be reminded that God had been with them through the wilderness and he had blessed them and kept them and brought them home. And the idea was that this illustrates this physical body serves that purpose while the resurrection body serves the promised land purpose. A house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. The second illustration is the changing of clothing. More actually, I suppose, the putting on of clothing over. Paul describes what happens if indeed we put off this tent that we live in now. The Christian thought is not like the Greek thought that just the body is evil and the spirit is good and so the spirit without the body would be best. The Christian thought is no. What we long for is to put on clothing that will last. To put on clothing over what we already are and what we already have. And then the third illustration grows out of that what is mortal may be swallowed up. I imagine a minnow and one of the huge fish that Barney later caught here coming up and just swallowing up this minnow. In Isaiah 25 in verse 8, the prophet looked forward to the time when death would be swallowed up. What Paul is saying here is here's mortality, and here it gets swallowed up by life. And it doesn't cease to exist, but it becomes a part of life now. In 1 Corinthians 15, at verses 53 and following, Paul describes it this way. For this perishable body must put on the imperishable, and this mortal body must put on the immortality. When the perishable puts on the imperishable, and the mortal puts on immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. What a wonderful thought, a wonderful image that is. A tent being taken down in favor of a permanent dwelling, being clothed with what is appropriate, and the mortal being swallowed up by life. Our faith is valuable because it gives our longing a fulfillment. Where are you going to get that answer to that longing? You can't tell me that just because you don't believe, you don't want to live. You're wanting to live, won't stop. So what's the answer to that longing? And then thirdly, Paul says that what we Christians believe gives our experience a responsibility. Not only what we do and say, but the things that are done and said to us. It's interesting to follow Paul's line of thought here, verses 6 through 10. So we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home with or away, we make it our aim to please Him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he's done in the body, whether good or evil. The mention of a judgment seat at the end of that reading is very profoundly important in a letter to Corinth. Archaeologists have discovered in the ruins of the ancient city of Corinth the bema, the judgment seat, the stone platform where Paul was drug in Acts 18, verses 12 and following, in the days of Gallio. And he's accused by the Jewish opponents of the time of doing and teaching things that are against the law. And old Gallio just simply says, this has to do with your religion. I'm not going to judge it. I'm not going to hear it. Get away from here. That's my rough paraphrase. So the Jew, Paul never got a chance even to answer their accusations. And so his opponents took a brother named Sosthenes aside there and just beat the tar out of him. And there was never an answer. Gallio did nothing. The judgment seat was inactive. So it would have meant something to them when Paul writes to the church in that place about everyone standing before the judgment seat of Christ. He says in this text here, we walk by faith and not by sight. Remember the description we mentioned earlier. That means that we're looking to faith not yet fulfilled. The world, the unbelieving world, neither walks by faith nor by sight. We act as if what we can see is not going to happen and that what we can't see yet doesn't exist in our world. We walk by faith and not by sight. So what we want is to be at home with the Lord. That's the object, that's our goal. We want to be at home with the Lord. But now in order to do that, verse 9 faces a reality. You're not going to be at home in someone's presence whom you have when you haven't cared about what he wanted. So Paul says we make it our aim to please him. And then the reason we make it our aim to please him is that we must all be laid bare, made manifest. Our lives must be opened up before the judgment seat of Christ. There are many wonderful passages on this truth. And if we had time, we could read more of them. But you see the idea here. Paul is saying, look, what we do in this body is not irrelevant. The things we say, the things we do, we're going to be accountable for. and the things that are said and done to us, whoever does them will be accountable for at the judgment seat of Christ, and that'll make all the difference. I found in one of the, I think this is from the Book of Virtues, maybe. This little poem. Alone I walked the ocean strand, a pearly shell was in my hand. I stooped and wrote upon the sand my name, the year, the day. As onward from the spot I passed, one lingering look behind I cast, a wave came rolling high and fast. And so, methought, 'twill shortly be with every mark on earth for me. A wave of dark oblivion sea will sweep across the place where I've trod the sandy shore of time and been to be no more. Of me, my day, the name I bore, to leave nor track nor trace. And yet, with him who counts the sands and holds the water in his hands, I know a lasting record stands inscribed against my name. Of all this mortal part has wrought, of all this thinking soul has thought, and from these fleeting moments caught, for glory or for shame. It has to be that way, or what we say and do does not matter. Of what value is what every faithful Christian believes? Well, it gives meaning to our struggle, fulfillment to our longing, and responsibility to our experience. And because it's of such value, of course it requires something from us. In verse 11 of this same chapter, Paul mentions our knowing the fear of the Lord. In other words, our respecting Him. In verse 14 of this chapter, it mentions the love of Christ, which controls us, constrains us. We respect the Lord's judgment. We respond to the Lord's love because we believe that what we believe in matters so much. If you hold to the faith of Christ, we encourage you not to lose heart. If you haven't yet confessed that faith, we encourage you to consider it and act on that good intention. If we can help you to do so, let us know today by coming while we stand and sing.